Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Today, the painful words of a father who lost his son.
My heart is crushed, but I'm a proud dad.
And why those words matter as the number of police officers being shot skyrockets. Plus, Twitter has a new member of its board of directors. The changes Elon Musk could bring to one of the world's most divisive platforms. And finally, a Democratic political operative believes the 2022 midterms are going to be a bloodbath for Democrats across the country, why he believes Seattle is to blame.
The activist left have a cultural disconnect problem.
Welcome to the Undivided Podcast. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you so much for listening. As I mentioned on my social media platforms, the podcast was a day late today because I had the absolute honor and privilege of participating in the public memorial for fallen Everett Police Department officer Dan Rocha yesterday. I just didn't think it was appropriate to talk any politics on my social platforms yesterday since I was involved in that ceremony. And so just wanted to sort of give it my full attention. And so I appreciate your understanding of that and of the podcast coming out today. And when I say this was really, I mean, one of the true honors of my career to be asked by the Everett Police Department to be there and be the master of ceremonies. I've covered, obviously, a lot of officer memorials over the past 10 or so years. And it's very, very different being there in person and being part of it. Obviously, very emotional. Just to reflect on, because I'm going to get into a story that is a little bit political, and I hate to mix politics too much into an officer's passing, but you know, some of these things are just reality and they need to be discussed. But I wanted to play for you one of the speeches that really stood out to me from the memorial, and it was Officer Rocha's dad.
As a parent, my first reaction when I heard about Dan was that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Upon further reflection, I knew that Dan would say he was in the perfect place at the perfect time to do what he does, serve and protect, and make a better world for his kids. My heart is crushed, but I'm a proud dad. Thank you.
We also heard from the brother-in-law of Officer Dan Rocha, Matt Nicholas, who, you know, it was hard to tell. I had a hard time knowing whether he was able to finish his speech or whether he cut it short. It was obviously very emotional for him to be talking about what Dan Rocha meant to him.
We must not wallow in our grief. The best thing that we can do to honor Dan is to live life to the fullest the same way Dan did. Dan was a son, a husband, a father, a friend, and a brother. He was my brother. We will never forget you. Rest easy, Danny. We have the watch.
Just to catch up folks who aren't familiar with Officer Rocha's life and his passing, he was 41 years old. He'd been with the Everett Police Department in Washington State since 2017. And before that, he'd been a parking enforcement officer. And one of the things that struck me about that is you have a lot of probably negative interactions, frustrating interactions with the public as a parking enforcement officer. People are never happy to see you, ever. And so it just struck me that even after doing that job, he wanted to become a police officer, even after, you know, having probably some unfortunate interactions with angry members of the public. So I think it speaks to what kind of person he was. Just 41 years old when he was killed. I'll give you just the general details of it, and it's relevant to the story I'm going to discuss coming up next. Officer Rocha had contacted 50-year-old Richard Rodder in a Starbucks parking lot. Apparently, Officer Rocha saw him transferring guns from one car into another car, and so that's why he approached him. In response, Richard Rodder, who has a lengthy criminal history, shot Officer Rocha and then ran over him as he fled. Now, the suspect got into a multi-vehicle crash down the road after a police pursuit. So he was arrested. He's facing first-degree murder charges. But Officer Rocha's murder came just a week after the murder of another officer in Washington State who was shot to death while carrying out a SWAT warrant down in Pierce County, Washington. Now, I saw this article on Sunday, and it really stopped me in my tracks. The headline, 101 police officers shot in the line of duty, a 43% increase from 2021. That's according to the National Fraternal Order of the Police. So again, so far in 2022, 101 officers have been shot in the line of duty and 17 of them killed as a result. That is a 43% increase from 2021 and a 63% increase compared to 2020. The national FOB president saying in the statement to Fox, "We are in the middle of a real crisis. The violence directed at law enforcement officers is unlike anything I've seen in my 36 years of law enforcement." He went on to say, "Last year was one of the most dangerous years for law enforcement, with more officers shot in the line of duty since the Fraternal Order of Police began recording this data." So I shared this article on social media, and I said, this is what I wrote on social media to accompany the article. I said, "But let's pretend there are no consequences to vilifying the police and going soft on criminals. Because in my estimation, this is a direct result of what started with the Defund the Police movement, which led to an exodus of officers, which led to some actual defunding, which started this long cycle of vilification of officers beyond what we had seen in previous years. And then it also coincided with some more progressive cities letting people out of jail or even prison due to the coronavirus pandemic. And just this general trend of, in part because of fewer officers being on forces, just this general trend of deprioritizing certain crimes. And to me, there is a very obvious circumstantial case to be made for why we're seeing, for example, a 63% increase in police shootings since 2020, this year compared to 2020. That's not just an anomaly. But it was interesting. So I posted this and I said what I said on social media, and some of the responses were so asinine. Tara says, "Let's pretend there is no reason to vilify some police officers." One Twitter user wrote, "So to be clear here, cops can't be criticized because it only puts them in more danger?" No, cops can be criticized. How many times have I said on this podcast that officers have a badge and a gun, they have the power of life and death over people, and when they screw up, they should be criticized? And when you recognize patterns in law enforcement, it has to be addressed. I've said it a million times, I'll say it again, but that doesn't mean that you vilify officers wholesale, or that because you have one or two bad officers on an agency, that politicians need to talk about defunding or divesting or completely abolishing the police. That's stupid. So no, it's not one or the other. And that's the mentality we have to get away from, that you either have to support every single police officer no matter what, or that you have to hate all police officers no matter what. That's stupid. So that comment's dumb. Let's see. James says, "Brandy, what's being vilified is police misconduct." No, that's not the case. Some people are vilifying police misconduct. I vilify police misconduct. But when you have a candidate for Seattle city attorney whose campaign is being supported by sitting elected officials in Seattle, and that candidate's Twitter account is calling cops serial killers, and when that candidate's campaign manager has a violent Twitter history that includes wishing death upon police officers, then that's not a vilification of only police misconduct. That's a vilification of the police. And if you believe that that vilification doesn't have any consequences, then you must believe that Trump's comments prior to the January 6th insurrection had no impact on the January 6th insurrection. But I know you don't believe that because you are hopelessly partisan and you only believe that words matter when the words are coming out of the mouth of someone who you agree with. So that is ridiculous. And again, I try to be a little bit bridging of divides on this show, but I'm not going to bridge divides with stupid people because it's not possible. So you have this Twitter thread of people who are so mad that I would suggest that hate for the police, explicit hatred directed at the police would lead to police being targeted more often. They're mad because they're being called out on their hateful bullshit. And again, I would ask you, if you're disagreeing that more hate being directed at police officers, not only by random people on the internet, but by politicians, does nothing to influence people's behavior towards the police, then you have to agree that Trump's remarks before the January 6th siege had no bearing on the decision of that crowd to storm the U.S. Capitol. Because if we're using consistent logic, and I'm following your logic, then certainly you believe both of those things. Except you don't. And then you have people who blame it on the pandemic. Oh, the pandemic. They're like, oh, I wonder what happened in those 2 years that would make the numbers go up so much. Well, you know what happened at the exact same time as the pandemic? The murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis and a wave of sometimes violent riots across the country where officers were vilified, where major cities like Seattle pledged to defund the police, where you had political candidates who ran on platforms of abolition, and where you had, at least in Seattle, an exodus of officers that has not relented. Fewer officers to go to serious calls, the longer wait times for backup. Again, this is a circumstantial case I could win in a court of law. The only aspect of the pandemic that I believe had any bearing on the number of police officers being shot and the number of police officers being killed over those 2 years is the decision of elected leaders not to book certain people in jail, to let people out of jail early, to let people out of prison early in some instances. That's the only part of the pandemic that I believe had a bearing on this spike in officer shootings. And to be frank, I don't even believe that those decisions were made because of real concerns over COVID-19. I believe they were made because of this pre-existing wave of decriminalization, of criminal justice reform, of going soft on crime, because apparently reforming the police means going soft on crime, and politicians can't figure out how to reform the police without going soft on crime. So I think they just used the pandemic as a convenient excuse to let criminals out of prison or not to book criminals into jail in the first place. But all these little Twitter people, they want to talk the talk, but they don't want to walk the walk. They want to vilify the police. They want to call police bastards. They want to call for police abolition. And then they don't want to take responsibility when we see a rise in police officers who are shot and sometimes killed in the line of duty. And don't even get me started on the people who believe that these shootings are a result of there being too many guns in America and America's gun problem. For the record, I don't own a gun. I really have no desire to own a gun, although day by day, I'm starting to reevaluate that. But I have said this on the podcast before, I don't want to hear another damn thing from Democrats about the need to clamp down on guns, the need to institute gun control legislation, unless you start throwing the freaking book at every single offender who uses a gun to commit a crime. Again, I don't want to hear a single Democrat call for gun control until you are leveraging the full extent of the law against those who are committing crimes with guns. When you're doing that, come back to me. Let's have a conversation about gun control priorities that you might have that you think could keep police officers safe and the public safe. But until you stop cutting deals with gun offenders and then turning around and acting like you care about gun violence, I don't want to hear a damn thing about it. So in summary, all these people who want to vilify the police for 2 years straight, want to vilify them wholesale without any care or concern for whether officers are doing a good, honorable job, they just hate all of them. And then when more officers like Dan Rocha, like Dom Collada are shot and killed in the line of duty, two exceptional young men who were the epitome of what we should want in a law enforcement officer. And then you want to run and hide behind your nameless, faceless Twitter handles like the true cowards you are and act like it is overblown to blame the murders of these officers on the vilification of the police. Frankly, you can go to hell. And if that language isn't bridging divides enough for you, I really can't bridge divides with people who are so morally bankrupt. All right, that leads me into the 2022 midterms and how some of these issues around the rise in crime, the murder of police officers are going to play politically and what it could mean for Democrats in the midterms. There was this great article in Post Alley, which is a news site based in Seattle. The headline of it, "The midterms are shaping up to be a bloodbath. It's Seattle's fault." The author of that article is Sandeep Kaushik. He is a Democratic political operative in Washington state who, again, believes the midterms are shaping up to be a bloodbath for Democrats, and it's Seattle's fault. I spoke with Sandeep about why. For listeners who are not familiar with you, introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi, my name is Sandeep Kaushik. I'm a political and public affairs consultant. I have a firm in Seattle called Soundview Strategies. We do some political campaign work, but mostly these days I do kind of public affairs work for, you know, companies and big nonprofits, stuff like that. And I used to be a journalist.
And fair to say you're still a Democrat?
Oh, I'm absolutely still a Democrat. You know, I'm absolutely a Democrat. I'm probably these days kind of more of a center left Democrat than a movement left Democrat.
So let's talk about this article. The headline's a good one. And if people haven't read your stuff, I was just telling you before we got on that you just, I love your writing. Just, it's entertaining to read. So the article Post Alley called "The Midterms Are Shaping Up to Be a Bloodbath. It's Seattle's Fault." So give me the nut graph of what your argument is in this article, and then we'll break it down a bit.
Yeah, I think the core of the argument that I'm making, and I've been making kind of versions of this for a while, is that I think the activist left, particularly in cities, you know, very progressive blue cities like Seattle or San Francisco or Portland, have a cultural disconnect problem, particularly with the kind of voters you need to win elections, you know, the kind of voters Joe Biden needed to win the presidency and to win the nomination. Those are typically voters in the suburbs who kind of can swing back and forth. Or these days, I think there's a real disconnect with Latino voters, in particular, non-college educated Latino voters. I mean, the Democratic Party is largely lost the white working class. That's happened over decades. The problem continues to get worse, but that's been a kind of known quantity for a while. But I think the my fear, and I think there's some evidence of that, is that we may be on the verge of starting to lose the brown and the black working class because you've got kind of educated progressives in cities like Seattle embracing a kind of set of cosmopolitan cultural assumptions that a lot of other people find off-putting or alienating.
And just as an example, I was reading the comments on this article before we really dive into it, and there was one that it was funny how unaware this person was that they were proving your point. "What a heaping pile of garbage this article is. It's insulting to informed, intelligent people. If I want to read CNN-type centrist idiotic talking points, I'd go to CNN. Yes, the Democrats are going to get slaughtered for the same reasons they always lose. It has nothing to do with policy. It has to do with most of the country being assholes and low-informed citizens."
That's not exactly a manifesto for how we're going to win the next election, right? I mean, it's problematic. And, you know, some other people who commented then sort of pointed that out, that, hey, you're kind of proving the author's point here, which I mean, let me be clear here. I also think the Republican Party and their activists have a serious cultural disconnect.
Yes.
With the kind of voters who win elections too. Yes. It may even be worse for them, but right now the Democrats happen to be the party that's in power. You know, there's a good piece in the New York Times a few days ago, with the guy I thought made a very smart argument where he was like, look, you've got two minority parties that are widely, widely disliked, but they're evenly matched. And so all the elections are close. So it leaves the losing side feeling like they don't have to change anything because they're going to win the next election. And then they do win a narrow election and then they get booted out the next time too, because most people are kind of don't agree with the worldview of the kind of polarized people on the left in the Democratic Party or the polarized people on the right in the Republican Party. And I think that's right. We're in this place where there was a study a few years ago of sort of looking at the demographic and some political polling data that sort of divided up the country into these different sort of what they called tribes. And they talked about the exhausted majority, which I think is a pretty good phrase. It said, you know, there's probably like 60% of the American population. So, you know, some of them lean left, some of them lean right, some of them are kind of apolitical. But they're not the polarized partisans who kind of tend to run the tend to sort of dominate at least the brand identity of each of the parties, right?
And that's because of the media, and they drive the conversation. When you say this exhausted middle, that's how I feel, except I don't have the ability to be exhausted by it because of my job is talking politics. Sure. But before we get to the central theme of this article, when you say the midterms are shaping up to be a bloodbath for Democrats, you're talking about something above and beyond what the party in power would normally face during a midterm election.
That's right. In any midterm election, typically, I think there's only been three times since the Civil War that the president's party in the midterms, in the first term after they've come to power, has gained seats in Congress in the election. Now, every other time, you typically lose seats. And so that's sort of built into the structure of this. It's sort of baked into the cake. But that's not what I'm talking about. I think what we're seeing right now in, you know, there's lots of public polling. The president's approval rating is down around 40%, which is kind of about where Trump's was at this point in his presidency. As I said, we're hemorrhaging voters in the suburbs. There's some really telling warning signs about Latino voters moving away from the Democrats. The majority of them will still vote Democratic, but not by nearly the same kind of margins, it looks like, as they had been in the recent past. And so that's a sign of a kind of potential. If the election were today, it'd be a blowout election. We would lose both houses of Congress. I think in Washington state, we could see one or both of the houses kind of shift from Democratic to the Republican side. I mean, it's pretty bad out there. I think we would probably see the Democrats lose the 8th congressional district here, and maybe it goes beyond that. The polling is really pretty stark.
So you talk about President Biden's own personal shift over the past couple years, and what you noted in the article is he ran on more of understanding what you call the true ideological center of the Democratic Party. But then in 2021, he really globbed on to the progressive wing of the party, the Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal's, and everything that they were pushing for at the time. Why do you think that the president shifted in the way that he did?
Man, I think there must be something in the water in D.C. I mean, I don't really have a great explanation for this. I think he campaigned as a center-left cultural traditionalist. And what I mean by that was, you know, he really talked up his roots in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, I get it, man. I know what it's like, you know, I know what it was like for my dad to have a job and the dignity that provided, you know, kind of talking about these sort of very foundational kind of traditional values, patriotism and honoring work, you know, work hard and get ahead, you know, the kind of American dream sort of ideal. And, you know, and that's where a majority of Democrats, particularly non-white Democrats, subscribe to those kind of traditional cultural values, which happen to be quite different and increasingly divergent from the sort of set of cosmopolitan values and culture that we see among certain segments of Seattle's, you know, activist class, right? And what happened was they came into power. And I think some of the people around the president, his chief of staff and some of his advisors, they're living in a bubble kind of inside the Beltway. And in that bubble, it seemed reasonable to them that we should go really big, right? We should try to throw everything into Build Back Better. Look, the largest constituency, the largest caucus in the Democratic Party in Congress is the New Democrats. They're bigger than the progressives. And the New Democrats said, hey, pick a couple of big ticket things, do those. Do them well. And if they had done that, they'd be in great shape right now. Instead, they tried to do everything in one big, massive, transformational $3.5 trillion Build Back Better package at a time when they had no margin for error, you know, only 50, you know, it's a 50-50 split in the Senate. And, you know, it didn't work. They fell on their faces, right? Because they ran into problems with some of the more conservative Democrats. But the bigger problem with that is that it gave credence to the right wing and the Republicans' argument that Joe Biden is just another partisan left Democrat from DC. And he and Bernie Sanders, there's no daylight between the two. Like when Bernie Sanders ran around or other people in the Progressive Caucus and said, our agenda is Joe Biden's agenda, They were telling the truth. That's right. Joe Biden and his team made that so. And that was a problem, right? Because it creates that it brands a sort of Democratic Party in the view of a lot of these kind of swing voters that, wait a minute, he's not the kind of, you know, more sort of culturally traditional kind of moderate, you know, center left middle guy that I thought he was.
Well, who do you think is the real Joe Biden? The Joe Biden he was for the last 40 years or the Joe Biden he showed in 2021?
I think he got out over his skis a little bit in 2021. I think they're starting to realize that. If you heard the big takeaway line from the State of the Union address, you know, the one that got quoted everywhere was fund the police, fund the police, fund the police. He said it like three times, right in a row. And that's a clear indication to me that people there in the White House and the West Wing have kind of figured out, wait a minute, some of these associations like defund and abolition, the kind of stuff you hear in Seattle, are just politically toxic, and we got to get away from that. We got to call it out. And I think he needs to do more of that. He just released his budget proposal. He talked about more funding for police, $100 million to combat crime, a big increase in the military budget, right? Those are kind of going back to, I think, where Joe Biden has been for most of his career, right? I mean, he's a Democrat. He's on the left. He's progressive. But, you know, but within a kind of cultural mainstream, I think.
But is it too late for Biden to change minds of those suburban voters, for instance, who saw what he ran on and then saw the switch he made in 2021? And all of a sudden, when things are looking bad, he's like, oh, fund the police. I mean, you can say it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to believe that that's your true intention or where the direction that you're going to take.
Well, there's a lot of time between now and November, right? Politics. You know, a lot can change, right? I mean, what if the Supreme Court comes back and overturns Roe v. Wade? You're a suburban woman living in Issaquah, and you're kind of irritated by the Democrats right now, and you start seeing stuff like that coming out of the Supreme Court, that might change your perspective a little bit. Or, you know, maybe we'll see some improvement in terms of gas prices or inflation. We've seen Democratic mayors now in some of these cities like Bruce Harrell or Erica in Seattle or Eric Adams in New York taking the crime issue seriously and centering it and saying we're not going to tolerate some of the stuff that's been happening on our streets anymore. I think that's all potentially helpful. So as I said at the end of the piece, I think Biden and the Democrats have dug themselves a hole, but there's some time here and maybe they can kind of dig their way out of it. But it's going to require, I think, a significant shift and a repetition and a willingness to sort of call out some of the things that people find alienated, some of the ideas that people find alienated.
And to end on this, this podcast is about trying to silence the fringes and encourage moderates to find their voice. And one of the things that I have called out Republican candidates for is trying to tie moderate Democrats to the left wing of the party. For instance, Jesse Jensen, who's running for a second time to try to unseat Dr. Kim Schreier in the 8th Congressional District, he's tried to tie her to like Shama Sawant as some radical progressive. And she's very clearly not. And it's something I've called him on in interviews before. But can you blame Republicans for trying to tie, and not just Republicans in Washington, across the country for trying to liken Democrats to Seattle, for instance?
Well, what they're doing is creating at times, I think it's a grotesque caricature of who the Democrats are. And
I don't disagree, but you're a political operative.
Right.
I'm
with you. That said, you know, if I was them, I'd be doing it too, right? Yeah, you know why? Because the polling shows it's working, right? You look at what happened in Virginia or, you know, the governor of New Jersey almost lost. Like, governor of New Jersey is not some kind of Seattle activist, you know, radical who wants to end the prosecution of all misdemeanor crimes or, you know, nonetheless, there's a branding problem that has started to emerge in the Democratic Party, and the Republicans are seeing their polling and they're using it, they're weaponizing it to their advantage, right? I mean, it'd be political malpractice for them not to be doing some of that.
The article is great. Again, for people who haven't read it, in Post Alley, the title, The Midterms Are Shaping Up to Be a Bloodbath. It's Seattle's Fault. When are you writing another one so I can read it?
I'm working on a piece. I need to finish this, but I've been working. I always actually started before I did this one called the theme of it is as bad as it is in Seattle right now, at least we're not Portland, right?
I always enjoy having someone on who can take a critical analysis of their own party, because it's so much more meaningful than someone from the other party just doing bashing for political purposes. And Sandeep, I wish he'd write more, because when he does, it's pretty exceptional. And I appreciate him coming on to talk a little bit about his article. Again, you can read it in Post Alley. The headline, "The Midterms Are Shaping Up to Be a Bloodbath. It's Seattle's Fault." All right, coming up, we're going to talk about Elon Musk and why he is my absolute hero for becoming the largest shareholder of Twitter. But first, I want to tell you about the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. I'm sure you've seen my commercials for them. You might even have called them if you're interested in getting a home loan or perhaps doing a refinance. They're great, great folks. They have jumped on board with Undivided because they believe in the mission. I've been incredibly grateful as well, and especially in light of recent events, for their steadfast support of law enforcement, which apparently is something that is a controversial position for businesses to take these days. So if you are in the market for a home loan or maybe a refinance, give 1530 Mortgage a call. If a refinance isn't for you right now, they will tell you. You have my word that they'll tell you if it's not right for you or if you should go in a different direction based on what your needs are and what you're looking to refinance for. So give them a call, 206-207-7777. You can also pay them a visit at 1530mortgage.com and tell them you heard about them on the Undivided podcast with Brandi Crews. 1530 Mortgage, NMLS number 1761573, Equal Housing Opportunity. Okay, I know we're going long today, but I've got to talk about Elon Musk, which I'm trying to get Elon Musk on the podcast. So I'm going to put that into the ether. It's being worked on, I think, behind the scenes, because he's one of my dream guests. First of all, he's this massively rich person who doesn't have to care about some of the issues he cares about, like free speech, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But he does, and he's just an interesting fellow. You should follow him on Twitter if you don't already. And speaking of Twitter, so Elon Musk, a couple weeks ago, he put out a poll on his Twitter account about Twitter. It was on March 25th, and he wrote, "Free speech is essential to a functioning democracy. Do you believe Twitter rigorously adheres to this principle?" The poll was 30% said yes, 70% said no. And in response to the Twitter poll, he wrote, "The consequences of this poll will be important. Please vote carefully." So fast forward to this week when Elon Musk purchased a 9% stake in the social media company, making him the largest shareholder. Not only that, but Twitter has given him a spot on their board of directors. Not that they had much of a choice, considering he bought the largest stake in Twitter. Now, Elon Musk has been incredibly critical of Twitter, and much of that criticism around the issue of free speech. He's called himself a free speech absolutist. He had a tweet on March 4th where he was talking about the war in Ukraine and Russia, and he wrote, "Starlink has been told by some governments to block Russian news sources. We will not do so unless at gunpoint. Sorry to be a free speech absolutist." And Starlink is their satellite system that provides internet. But his newly bought power over Twitter has some left Twitterverse very, very concerned. I saw one tweet saying, "If Elon Musk reinstates Donald Trump's Twitter account, will everyone leave?" I was like, no, because I'm an adult. And I don't let the one person have that much control over my mental health and well-being. But it's very, very clear that the divide on Twitter is that over Elon Musk now, you know, having this 9% stake, is that the left thinks it's going to be bad and the right thinks it's going to be good. And it's hard to argue that conservatives have been censored more on Twitter. A recent example that was really bothersome to me was the Babylon Bee, which, if you're not familiar with it, it's like The Onion, but for conservatives, kind of. And one of the articles they wrote had the headline, "The Babylon Bee's Man of the Year is Rachel Levine." Well, Rachel Levine is a transgender woman, so someone who transitioned from man to woman. And you probably recognize that name because Levine has been the United States Assistant Secretary of Health since March of 2021. And so on this satirical site, the Babylon Bee was saying that Rachel Levine was the man of the year. Now, the Babylon Bee account got suspended for that. Twitter wrote that the reason for the suspension was based on their rule that, quote, "You may not promote violence against, threaten, or harass other people on the basis of race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, religious affiliation, age, disability, or serious disease." So Twitter obviously thinks that article, which again is for a site that is satirical in nature, that it violated their rules against harassing someone on the basis of gender identity. After that, the Babylon Bee's CEO also got locked out of Twitter. So there's been a couple instances, and you know, the decision to ban former President Donald Trump from Twitter forever is one that has angered a lot of conservatives, and you can understand why a lifetime ban from social media is a very, very, very big deal. And now all you have all these people on left Twitter absolutely losing their minds over the thought that with Elon Musk now on the board of directors, Twitter won't censor as many conservatives. But it's fascinating the way that this is being spun. The Washington Post had this business column saying, Elon Musk's Twitter investment could be bad news for free speech. So here you have someone who spends billions of dollars to purchase the largest stake in Twitter because they're angry about Twitter not adhering to free speech tenets. And you have the Washington Post, and it was actually written by Timothy L. Bryan for Bloomberg and shared by the Washington Post. But you've got this guy making some bizarre argument that someone who spent all this money because he's angry about free speech is somehow going to be bad for free speech on Twitter. And I read this whole article multiple times, and I still cannot figure out, because there's no argument made in this article about why Elon Musk buying Twitter would be bad for free speech. I'm trying to like read between the lines of it. The author, if I can try to get into his head, thinks that I guess maybe Elon Musk is buying Twitter to tank it or something and then build a platform of his own. And so by doing that, he would hurt free speech because he would tank Twitter, which, you know, a bunch of people go on to share their own speech. But it's just like this whole article built off like assumptions and guesses, and it's very, very strange. And even Elon Musk responded to it. He said, WAPO, always good for a laugh. So anyway, I think it's very telling that you only have folks on the left who are angry about this. And I can only guess that it's because they believe they're going to be treated the same way as folks on the right have. But, you know, for people to be so up in arms about this a couple days after Elon Musk purchases Twitter and not to wait to see, okay, what does he implement? It's just interesting. It's telling. The first kind of tweet he had put out about what he might do, I don't know if this is a joke, but he said, do you want an edit button? And for those who are familiar with Twitter, this is a very widespread frustration with Twitter that you can't go back and edit, like if you misspell a word and then you either have to choose to delete it and repost it or whatever, and it's very annoying. And right now his poll has more than 4 million votes and 73% want an edit button. I will say I'm a little skeptical of an edit button, and it's only because of this. If I retweet someone, let's say, and then they go back and edit the tweet to like say something else, and now I've retweeted it, then that makes me look bad. And so I don't know how the edit button would work. And that, so the details of it would matter to me. So anyway, it's just, you know, there's so many of us who are frustrated with Twitter, who are like walking on eggshells with what we tweet because we don't want to get blocked or banned or put in Twitter jail. And Elon Musk is frustrated about that. And he's like, well, I'm rich. I'll just buy a bunch of stock in it and get seated on the board of directors and just change it. And so I just love that. I love that he cares enough. So I had to talk about Elon Musk. He's my hero this week. We'll see what he does with Twitter. And maybe this weird article from Bloomberg is right, that he just wants to tank Twitter and build something new. I think that that's a, I don't think that's the case, but I guess you never know, right? All right, that's it for this episode of the Undivided Podcast. If you haven't become a subscriber to Undivided already, please consider doing so for as little as $5 a month. You can subscribe, get the full suite of video content along with these podcasts, patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. And by doing so, you are helping to build this movement to give common sense a comeback. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.